Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meum, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is July 2nd, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Take Me to the Rivaroxaban, Outpatient Treatment of Venous Thromboembolism. But before I get started on today's episode of the SGEM, I just wanted to talk briefly about my SMAC Chicago experience. SMAC stands for Social Media and Critical Care, and it brings together the best educators of the foam world and critical care leaders. I was so excited to attend, and I just couldn't hide it, and I did lose control, but I liked it. SMAC lived up to all the hype and expectations, so many amazing experiences, it's hard just to name a few. But as usual, I will summarize the experience into my top five. The first thing I wanted to mention was meeting all the amazing FOMED friends in person. And it would be silly to try to name them all individually for fear of leaving someone out. But be assured it was an absolute pleasure to meet each and every one of you. The second thing was the musical performances. We did a live performance of the SMAC Cup Song featuring the very talented Eve Purdy. Eve is a social media superstar who is also pitch perfect. Me, not so much. She led the student volunteers in a live version of the Cup Song. We also had the world premiere of the SMAC Run Song featuring Natalie May from St. Emlyn's. She was a triple threat. She could sing, she could dance, and she could run. The third thing I wanted to mention was the Rory Spiegel debate. It was a cage match with the EM nerd on whether or not to read the primary literature. There were a few ad hominem attacks, and our debate will be an SGEM extra posted later this summer. Number four is the paperclip talk I gave. Yes, a talk about a paperclip. If you want to know what a paperclip has to do with making knowledge translation happen, then watch for the SGEM Extra this summer. And the fifth and final thing was the Canadian foam. As a secret special surprise, I brewed some craft Canadian IPA beer. It was transported across international borders with a guy in a van a couple of weeks before the conference. The hotel was kind enough to keep it in cold storage for me, and I thought it would be a great idea to present some of my favorite foam providers with a six-pack of some homemade foam. It was a huge success, and from all reports, the beer was excellent. There were many other highlights to the SMAC experience, and if you want to know what I'm talking about, then save the date June 13th and 16th of 2016 for SMAC Dub. Yes, SMAC is going to be in Dublin, Ireland. Well, that's enough SMAC talk. It's time for this week's episode of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, and it's another SGEM hot off the press. Joining me as always for the SGEM Hop is Captain Cranium himself, Chris Carpenter from Washington University. Welcome back to the SGEM, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. It's an honor to be back with you on another episode of SGEM Hop, merging the worlds of traditional academic peer review with the rapidly expanding and impactful world of social media.
And the previous SGEM Hops, they've been really great at knowledge translation. I've seen the altmetric scores. They're through the roof.
Yeah, they're very impressive. The altmetrics are one way to measure the dissemination of research via social media. As long as social media aficionados used academic EM HTML, which we provide with this blog, the altmetrics will track blogs and tweets and Facebook and Mendeley and Wikipedia and Google Plus activity. For the four previous SGEM Hop original research articles, the altmetrics range from 15 to 49, including the 13th highest ranked article in academic EM history. For a frame of reference, the typical altmetric for an article is somewhere around 0 or 1. Thank you to the SGEM Hop audience and the support of the AEM editorial board. This series has been a knowledge dissemination success.
You know what, Chris? I'm not going to rest on our laurels. Let's get this one into the top 10. So what do we have for the SGEM Hop this time?
we have a new paper on outpatient management of DVT and PE with rivaroxaban.
And which author did we get to agree to be on the show?
Only the undisputed EM world expert in this area, Dr. Jeff Klein.
Now, I usually give the bio about our guest skeptic, but how about you telling those one or maybe two S-gemmers out there who don't know who this Jeff Klein guy is?
Jeff Klein is the Vice Chair of Research in Emergency Medicine and a Professor of Physiology at Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. He is one of the smartest individuals in any field whom I've ever met, no exaggeration. Most of you probably know him as the originator of the PERC rule. His diagnostic research interests expand well beyond that, though, to focus on human effect analysis, pretest probability, and capnography to reduce medical imaging. And his human treatment research includes randomized trials of fibrinolysis and inhaled nitric oxide. His lab work focuses on mechanisms and treatment of acute pulmonary hypertension from PE and animal models of PE and nanoparticle-delivered plasmid for clot lysis. How's that for high tech?
Ooh, nanoparticles. I am absolutely loving it, but I've got to remain skeptical of this guy. All right, Jeff, time to meet you. Welcome to the S-Gem.
Well, this is a great honor. I feel like I should have a cape or something after this.
Well, it would have to have a big K on it.
Maybe a tiara.
Tiara! Well, you've got a special announcement. Speaking of tiaras, you've just taken on a new position at Academic Emergency Medicine.
Yes, I have. Effective January 1st, 2016, I will be the Editor-in-Chief of Academic Emergency Medicine. I'll be taking over from the esteemed David Cohn, who has led the journal fabulously for the past, I believe, 6 years. And I look forward to interactions like this because I think the Skeptic's Guide is a model of the future for publishing, especially in emergency medicine, where so many of our learners are online.
Well, it's a privilege to have you on, but we're going to put you through your paces. We're going to expect a little work today, and we frame these podcasts with a case, Jeff. So, Chris, you've got a case to present, and then we're going to go through some background information, and then we're going to talk about your recent hot-off-the-press paper. So, Chris, give us a case.
So a 55-year-old man presents with chest pain and shortness of breath. You risk stratify him appropriately as non-high risk, and his D-dimer comes back elevated at 720. A CT scan confirms a segmental pulmonary embolism.
And venous thromboembolism is a common diagnosis. It's not like you haven't seen this before, Jeff. But according to Rosen's textbook, approximately 1 out of every 500 or 1 in 1,000 ED patients have a PE.
Yeah, and the per-patient inpatient admission cost for PE in the U.S. ranged from $25,000 to $44,000 in the years 1998 to 2006, with post-hospitalization warfarin and lab testing estimated at over $2,600.
And historically, these patients, they were all checked right in. Come on right in. We're going to get you started on treatment.
Yeah, it was a no-brainer when I was training. And we currently discharge in the U.S. only about 1% of PE patients and maybe a few more DVT patients in the literature that I've seen. But our admitting services are asking us to do so much more frequently, maybe as much as 20% of the time.
But you know, Chris, us Canadians, we're a little different. We've got a paper going back to 2000 demonstrating the safety of outpatient management of PEs, and a pragmatic evaluation of ambulatory management of PEs in Canada came out in 2008, and that was by COVAX, and it showed that 50% of patients are being safely treated as outpatients.
Ken, at WashU in 2013, we actually conducted a Knowledge Translation Journal Club on this very topic with our hospitalists in an attempt to develop a mutually agreeable protocol to identify individuals appropriate for outpatient management. We developed an algorithm that we still use and that is part of this edition of SGEM Hot for you, for the listeners who might be interested. But one of the biggest uncertainties at the end of that journal club was if and how to manage these patients with newer anticoagulants, since at that time the only data that existed was for warfarin.
So, Jeff, why do you think there's been such a divide between the two countries in their management of pulmonary embolisms?
I think the simple answer is primary care. If you look at France, Germany, England, Italy, and Canada, many of the patients that are diagnosed that historically were diagnosed with PE in the emergency department were referred by a primary care physician to get imaging done. So it was a very logical handoff that the patient would be diagnosed, and it was a sort of a usual frame of reference that we took care of the problem. We're going to start you on blood thinners. We got somebody to follow you up with to do your INRs and to answer questions. And in the United States, our primary care is just so much weaker that everyone had to come in the hospital to learn how to inject themselves with Lovenox and to get arranged for PTINRs, especially in urban teaching centers where many of the patients are low income and really needed a lot more hand-holding, so to speak.
And Jeff, our hospitalist at our journal club pointed out that there's no randomized trial showing that patients admitted for PE do better than patients treated at home. They challenged us to prove the flip side.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I mean, I don't know that we have much evidence that the hospital does any good for anything, but we were put to the test with this because it was just what was done.
Well, now that we have these new oral anticoagulants, I was wondering, we have the world expert on VTE. I was wondering if you could give us a little primer about these things, and I had five questions for you, if that's okay. And the first one was, what are these new drugs?
Well, the ones that are cleared now for VTE are, in alphabetical order, apixaban or Eliquis, edoxaban, dabigatran, maybe I got it not quite alphabetically, dabigatran and rivaroxaban. The drugs that are most relevant to us are apixaban and rivaroxaban because those are the only two that have FDA clearance to dry start, meaning that you could diagnose a PE or a DVT and give the patient a pill in the emergency department, no shots of heparin at all, and you're doing just fine. I think an interesting point that raises a lot of eyebrows is the time to therapeutic anticoagulant effect, meaning good factor 10 inhibition, is actually a little quicker if you give a dose of rivaroxaban by mouth than if you give a shot of heparin or shot of Lovenox subcutaneously.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I didn't know that, and I like the dry start. Ooh, yeah, we can dry start them.
Yeah, you can't do that with edoxaban or dabigatran. So, you know, we could always do it off-label, but if you're going to go with the label, you might as well use these other two, apixaban and rivaroxaban. And neither requires monitoring or any type of change in their dietary habit. In fact, you really should take rivaroxaban with food. It's actually absorbed better with food than without food. And it's important to know that both of these drugs have foundations that are set up. First, if the patient has any health insurance, they can call a 1-800 number and they will get a number that they can take to their pharmacist, and then they'll get mailed a card that they will get their drug for no more than $20 a month. And for both of them, they're now down to $10 a month. So if they got insurance, it's 10 bucks a month, no matter how bad their insurance is. If they're completely poor, they're completely impoverished, have no Medicare or no Medicaid coverage, both of them have foundations that your care coordinators can get the patient qualified and they can get their drug for free for a year. So these drugs can get extended to our most needy, low-income patients.
Well, that's great. And just remind everybody, without going into too many technical details, how do they actually work?
The two that I'm naming that you can dry start, our new term, apixaban and riva, they're small molecules that sit in the active site of factor 10A and inhibit 10A. And remember, 10A sits at the bottom of the contact or extrinsic pathway, as well as the intrinsic pathway. And if you throttle 10A, you prevent the production of thrombin. No thrombin means no fibrin. So it's a nice trigger or control point. The dabigatran actually directly inhibits thrombin, a step down from factor 10A. The dabigatran, of course, requires the heparin roll-in. So I'm advocating more for the other two that don't require heparin.
So that would be the wet start as opposed to the dry start.
There's a term. Now we got it.
Now we got it down. Now, you mentioned, you know, the two drugs, they have the indication for VTE. What are the other indications for these drugs?
Let's see. Atrial fibrillation and prophylaxis for VTE after joint surgery only.
Excellent. And what do you think about the safety profile of these new pharmaceuticals?
Well, across the board, both Apix and Riva have about a 50% reduction in major bleeds. And then the important thing is everyone worries about reversal of these drugs. But if you look at the patients who have bleeding in the randomized trials, and this includes Einstein, which was open label, so when the patient came to the emergency department with bleeding, the doc could rapidly find out if they were on warfarin or not. And in most of the countries where these studies were done, prothrombin complex was widely used for warfarin. The patients who had bleeding did worse with warfarin than those who had bleeding with either apixaban or rivaroxaban. So the argument that you need a reversal agent, besides, by the way, there's no reversal agent for warfarin, there's only a correction of protein factors, really doesn't hold a lot of water when you look at the science. But it comes down to the fact that doctors fear the fear of bleeding more than the actual bleeding itself. And we just have a funny feeling. We want to give a drug that we can correct. You can actually correct both Riva and apixaban with four-factor complex, such as K-Centra, 50 units per kilogram, fairly well in vitro. And there are two new agents coming down the pike that are directly engineered drugs that will completely reverse these agents. One of them is andnexant that was just published in the New England Journal last week.
Oh, and we are going to do an SGEM of that. I've got one of those planned. So the last question is, how do you, like, and I don't want you to hold back here, how do you think these new drugs compare to warfarin overall, the big picture? Is this a game changer?
It completely is. It's transformed the way we take care of clot patients. And for them, it's liberating. I've cared now for almost 300 patients in our clot clinic, and probably 100 of them have been on warfarin before. They had recurrent VTEs. Yeah, we've asked patients to write their thoughts about being on the new oral anticoagulant compared to warfarin. And they'll say these over-the-top hyperbolic statements like, this drug saved my life. I despised giving myself shots. It's fascinating how much patients hate giving themselves enoxaparin shots and how they view it as disfiguring and how much they were dependent upon other people. And they just feared them so much that the patients really love them. And the other thing is these drugs are safe. There's no increase in recurrence rate. It's about the same as it is with warfarin, maybe a little less. And the bleeding rate is cut in half, and the bleeds that you have are much more minor. And I'll give a practical point for ER docs out there listening. If you prescribe rivaroxaban or apixaban to a young woman, the one thing I would tell her is this might increase your menstrual period flow. Menorrhagia is probably the one thing that we see that we do have to do occasional adjustments in the clinic. And all we do is hold the pill for a day. No big deal. You can't do that with warfarin. Hold the pill for a day, the menorrhagia goes away.
We're picking up lots of tips today, but we've got to get into the actual critical appraisal. So Chris, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer?
Can low-risk emergency department patients with acute venous thromboembolism be safely discharged home on rivaroxaban?
And now we get to get the reference from one of the authors. Jeff, what's the actual title of what will be hot off the press in AEM?
Immediate discharge and home treatment of low-risk venous thromboembolism diagnosed in two U.S. emergency departments with rivaroxaban, a one-year pre-planned analysis.
And Chris, what was the population they looked at?
It was adult patients at low risk for adverse outcomes with newly diagnosed PE or DVT and presenting in academic EDs.
So they used a modified Hestia exclusion criteria to identify those low-risk patients. But what was the intervention, Chris?
It was rivaroxaban, 15 milligrams PO twice daily for 21 days, then 20 milligrams a day for an unspecified duration that was really stratified for the patient.
And then patients optionally got a first dose of enoxaparin 1 milligram per kilogram sub-Q. What was the comparison?
This was an observational trial, so no comparator.
And how about their outcomes?
Recurrent venous thromboembolism or hemorrhage.
Yeah, and for the bleeding or the hemorrhage, they used the International Society of Thrombosis and Hemostasis definition of major or clinically relevant non-major bleeding.
Right.
One of my favorite parts of the SGEM hop, Chris, as you know, is I get the author themselves to read their own conclusions, so I don't have to make air quotes. So, Jeff, what were the conclusions to your paper?
Patients diagnosed with VTE and immediately discharged from the emergency department while treated with rivaroxaban had a low rate of VTE recurrence and bleeding.
Excellent. Okay, so we've got 11 quality checklists for observational trials. Question number one, Chris, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, it did.
And did the authors use the appropriate methods to answer their question?
Well, that's debatable because a randomized control trial would be optimally what we'd want to use.
Okay. Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Unsure. We've got some external validity issues that we'll raise in a few minutes.
Okay. Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes, we think so.
And how about the outcome? Was it actually accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
And have the authors identified all the important confounding factors?
Yes, we believe so.
And was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
Yes, they only lost 3 out of 106.
And how precise were those results in estimation of the risk?
Well, we'll present the 95% confidence intervals, but we think they're fairly tight.
And, you know, do you believe the results?
Yes, this has base validity to me, and it's something that we've been waiting to know.
And can you apply these results to your own local population?
Again, some external validity questions that I'd be curious to see how Jeff responds, but there's some things that we're not sure about.
And do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
I don't know that there's a lot of evidence out there for these new anticoagulants, but what there is, I think it is consistent, yes.
Okay, so let's go through the key results. They had a total of 106 patients discharged with venous thromboembolism. And which type were they, Chris?
They were two-thirds, 67% with DVT, 28% with PE, and 5% had both DVT and PE.
Chris, I know that they discharged 106 patients and treated them as outpatients, but how many of the total DVTs and PEs were actually discharged and treated as outpatients?
That was 27% of the PE patients and 51% of the DVT patients.
Okay, so that 106 represents just over a quarter of their PE patients they were able to do this method, and just over half of their DVT patients. That's interesting.
That's far better than we're doing today.
Now, how about their primary outcome for recurrent or new VTE while on rivaroxaban?
Yeah, zero of the 106 patients had recurrent VTE. 95% confidence interval around that, 0 to 3.4%. The recurrence, you worry about when they stop their rivaroxaban, do they have recurrent venous thromboembolism? After 6 months of follow-up, 3 of 106 patients, or 3%, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.6% to 8%, had new venous thromboembolism after discontinuing therapy.
So when we're looking at the main results, I also want to know about harm. How about deaths? Were there any deaths, Jeff?
We had two patients that died from causes that were unrelated to clots or the rivaroxaban therapy.
And how about bleeding?
No patients had major bleeding events.
There were three patients lost to follow-up, and you assumed to have a good outcome. And we're going to talk about this in the next section. And that's where we get to talk a little nerdy with you, Jeff. But I want to start because I want to congratulate you and your team on getting another great article published. And there are a few things, though, that we want to go through with regards to this manuscript. And Chris, you were going to lead this off.
Yeah, Jeff, you report two approaches that might be difficult for some settings to replicate. First, you did not use a one-size-fits-all duration of rivaroxaban therapy. Instead, you really shaped it towards the individual patient by a combination of, you said, published criteria, evidence, clinician judgment, and shared decision-making to decide the optimal duration of anticoagulation for each patient. Would other healthcare settings without an ED-led anticoagulation clinic and without access to the world's authority on VTE be able to provide such individualized care?
I think so. We've got a matrix that we use that helps guide this a little more specifically. For example, if we have a patient with a below-knee clot that's otherwise low risk, we might only treat them for 21 days. And a patient that's a male that has a recurrent pulmonary embolism needs to be treated for life. The general simple statement is all DVTs 3 months, all PEs 6 months. But you have to tailor this. The best evidence we have came from Coumadin. We don't have any long-term follow-up studies with rivaroxaban to really come up with decision rules or scoring systems to determine length of treatment with these new drugs. So we have to draw from warfarin-related studies. And they all agree that males are at higher risk than females, that patients with post-thrombotic syndrome, patients with more clot, like PE, need to be treated longer. And we're ER docs, and we know the problems with anticoagulation. So if you've got an alcoholic who's fallen a couple of times this week and has bruises all over him, and his daughter's in the room and says, well, he's probably not going to take his medicine anyway. Well, that might be a patient that we think, hey, let's try to get 6 months of anticoagulation, then stop, versus the college professor who meticulously brings in all his pills, takes his medicine exactly on time, and doesn't ride horses or juggle chainsaws. That guy might be a good person to keep on for life. So it just, it ends up, it has to be common sense and to some degree patient preference. In fact, a large degree patient preference. And that's been going on for years in Coumadin clinics. That is not a different thing. Talk to anyone that runs a Coumadin clinic. That's how they do it.
And is juggling chainsaws, is that a big thing down there?
That's an American thing, and we have a contest, but you actually have to be taking anticoagulation to enter.
Oh, we just juggle bottles of maple syrup, and if they break, then we're in trouble.
Did you bring that to Indiana from North Carolina, Jeff?
I did, and also the 8-foot-tall porch with the 90-year-old taking Coumadin for AFib while he's drinking alcohol. All the porches are 8 feet tall that they fall off of.
We get guys going up ladders, and I have a little metric. The, you know, whatever decade in life, that's how high the step ladder is for to clean out their eaves in the fall. So if they're 80, they're up an 8-foot ladder. If they're 100, they're up a 10-foot ladder.
Exactly.
So you used a special anticoagulation clinic staffed by your team, to which most emergency physicians in other settings wouldn't have access to that. And in many urban settings, access to the anticoagulation clinics can take months to schedule from the ED. And that serves as a significant barrier to discharge some of the ED physicians, sending them home.
I think you're exactly right. We started the clinic to show it could be done. And I think you're right. I mean, this is something that I spend all of my time thinking about and doing. I was an investigator in the phase 3 qualifying trials for apixaban and rivaroxaban. So I had unique experience using these drugs. And I thought, man, I'm probably the best person to get this going. And by sort of leading by example, we now discharge about half of our patients to their primary care physicians. So the PCPs have picked this up in Indianapolis and are doing it on their own. But we wanted to show that it could be done, get a publication out. And we've now treated about 300 patients, but more and more of them are going to their family practitioners. I think you raise a good point about other low-income settings. And, maybe still some patients could go to a federal qualified clinic, any place that it has the ability just to see the patient and answer their questions. Oh, and by the way, at our 3-week follow-up, that was kind of the general scheduled first visit, we don't really do anything. All we do is say, do you have your medicine? Are you getting your medicine? And then we answer all of their unrelated questions that have nothing to do with blood clots or taking their pills, and they are happy. They move on. So there's really not a lot of complex medicine that goes on at these clinics.
Another point that the authors make, Jeff, is that adoption of the rivaroxaban protocol by our ED faculty and house staff was rapid and enthusiastic. That was amazing to me because I can't get our faculty to be rapidly enthusiastic about anything. And in other settings that lack an opinion leader with acknowledged expertise in VTE management and implementation processes, early adoption might be significantly more challenging. Do you think that might be the case?
Oh, no. Here's why it was rapid and quick. It was less work for our doctors. So instead of having to fight with the hospitalist to admit the patient, they just filled out a form, sent it off, and discharged the patient. And so the house staff and the faculty loved it. It was made their job easier. So that was why the adoption went faster.
Okay.
So there's a few questions we wanted to move on from the anticoagulation clinic and actually look at the external validity that Chris mentioned earlier. And so the first thing I wanted to talk to you about was, you mentioned that you did a chart review to identify the VTEs or bleeding events, but you don't report any chart review methods. What did you use?
Yeah, that's interesting. So if you look at the qualifying trial for apixaban or the Einstein study, hey, you know what? I did those trials. And you know what I did? I looked at the chart just exactly like I did for this study. Every prospective study looks at the chart to get its answer. That's the way it's done. Now, we also called our patients. In some cases, we called doctors and we had other information. So this wasn't a retrospective chart review like the Gilbert and Lowenstein article deals with, although those methods are important when you're going back and looking at the chart. We had structured things we were looking for that were part of the prospective protocol. So I bristle at that a little bit. This is not retrospective looking at the records. It's exactly what we do to prospectively collect data in patients that are involved in randomized controlled trials.
Oh, Chris, we're getting him to bristle. So we're being true skeptics, making him believe in what he's doing. So excellent. You've got the second question, though.
So, Jeff, you used a modified Hestia criteria and the predictor of mortality from pulmonary embolism and cancer, the Pompe-C, to identify low risk. But I didn't see any evidence that the modified Hestia criteria predict adverse outcomes in these patients, or that the Pompe-C predicts adverse outcomes in non-cancer patients.
Well, Hestia has been validated in numerous settings, and there was a 550 pulmonary embolism patient cohort that was presented at ISTH in Toronto last week, demonstrating that even the addition of BNP did not really help Hestia. So there's pretty good evidence that you can discharge patients that are Hestia negative and have very good 30-day outcomes, including an almost zero rate of VTE recurrence.
Do you think your modifications affect that prognostic accuracy at all, or make no difference?
Well, we really didn't modify it except to say that any dose of narcotics that the patient got IV in the emergency department was an exclusion, whereas the original Hestia was something like 24 hours of narcotics or something like that. So it wasn't much of a modification. And I'll tell you, the biggest issue we have with our clot patients, it's pain control. That has nothing to do with blood clots. It has to do with chronic pain, like back pain and things like that. That's the single biggest issue we have in clinic, is when the patients start asking for narcotics. So that issue of IV narcotic use in the emergency department is really just more of a general patient care thing. But it's a common problem in all patient populations, including these.
All right, another tough question for you, Jeff. You report no sensitivity analysis for the three patients who were completely lost to follow-up. And instead, you assume that no adverse VT events or outcomes occurred in these three patients. Now, I'm a glasses half full kind of guy too, but you know what? I thought we needed to look at the glasses half empty. What happens if you consider the worst case scenario and all these people died or bled? How would that impact your data and your conclusions?
Well, this is the power of the skeptic's guide, because I get to come and talk to you about the real deal. The real deal is we knew those three guys were okay, but they were in a place that we couldn't get to them. You want to know where they were?
Absolutely.
They were incarcerated. Now, since we've published this paper, these three people have reemerged. They're all fine. They are not dead. They did not have recurrence that I know of. Now, it's possible they had recurrence and never got diagnosed, because they live difficult lives. And, you know, they might have suffered a DVT and are just sort of walking around with it. But to our knowledge, we have really good knowledge that none of them had anything that was really life-altering to the point where they even went to the emergency department and got diagnosed.
Isn't this great that we get a deeper and richer and more meaningful understanding that you could read in just a manuscript? So I really appreciate that. The questions aren't done yet, though, Chris. You still got another one.
Yeah, you provide rivaroxaban free of charge, or at least deeply discounted, for up to a year for the largely indigent population. And I'm wondering, just trying to take this to a national scope across the United States, all 50 states, whether manufacturers or state Medicaid programs would be able or willing to provide free or very cheap rivaroxaban on such a larger scale, should your proposed protocol become standard of care everywhere. Do you think that would be an issue, Jeff?
Let's take it one at a time. First, it's a preferred drug on most Medicaid formularies, so if the patient has Medicaid, no problem. If the patient has Medicare, we can run into a problem in October. Ken, we have a thing called Medicare in the United States, and it is not perfect. In October, around that time, is when this thing called the donut hole kicks in. And that's when patients have lots of medications, can run out of Medicare money if they don't have a supplement. So we do have that for the Medicare patients that comes up from time to time and can be quite difficult. You know, I'm not going to lie, that's even required some very clever ways of getting medicines for a few Medicare patients initially. Now let's turn to the most indigent patients, those that maybe have Medicare, Medicaid and don't know it, those that don't have any Medicaid and have no money. There's this thing called the J&J Foundation, and also the Pfizer has an equivalent foundation, but it might be actually administered through Bristol-Myers Squibb. I'm not positive, but both of them have foundations that the patient can be qualified for. It does require you either to really care about this as a physician or to have a care coordinator go in and enter the patient's information and get things set up. And immediately, right there in the emergency department, the patient can be qualified, can go to a pharmacy and get their drug for free for a year. So these foundations work very well. They get the patients their drug and really help with the generalization to the most low-income patients, which is a really important mission for us in Clot Clinic.
So the last question I had for you is, you did not compare this to standard care, such as admitting these low-risk patients to the hospital and starting them either on warfarin or rivaroxaban.
That is true, and I think that a true skeptic would like to know a comparison between outpatient treatment with rivaroxaban to being admitted to the hospital for usual care. So there's a randomized trial that's getting started now. It's called the Mercury PE study. It is funded by Johnson & Johnson. And in disclosure, I am on the steering committee for Mercury PE. And as part of the steering committee, I am paid a stipend. The Mercury PE randomized trial will randomize 350 PE patients diagnosed in the emergency department to either immediate discharge with rivaroxaban or usual treatment. Usual treatment, we believe, will be the patient gets admitted and maybe about 50-50 put on warfarin versus a NOAC, one of the new anticoagulants that we talked about earlier. However, I'm kind of concerned in the study that we're going to see drift, and we'll see a very few patients by the end of the study, even in the wild type, even in the usual care group, who are admitted for more than 23 hours.
All right, Chris, time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare to the ESGEM's conclusions.
Well, Ken, we agree that this preliminary study demonstrates apparent efficacy and safety of rivaroxaban in urban teaching ED settings for outpatient management of significant portions of venous thromboembolism patients.
And additional studies from more heterogeneous ED settings other than the, you know, Jeff Klein Center of Excellence, and preferably from some randomized control trials, which sounds like that's what's going to happen,
yep,
before widespread application of this protocol is reasonable. But how about giving us a bottom line?
Well, my bottom line is that one observational study from two Indianapolis hospitals implies that rivaroxaban administered for variable durations of time for patients newly diagnosed with VTE in the ED is reasonably safe and effective.
However, Chris, you know, practice changing based on one single non-randomized study is unjustified, and multiple implementation barriers still need to be evaluated and overcome before this is a widespread application of this protocol. But can you give us a case resolution?
Yeah, our 55-year-old gentleman is presented with this appropriate information. He's low risk, has a drug plan for rivaroxaban, and can get follow-up in a couple of weeks. You discuss the options, including admission or outpatient management, and using shared decision-making, he decides to go home on rivaroxaban.
So how are you going to apply this literature clinically?
I think it's certainly reasonable to discuss outpatient treatment with rivaroxaban or warfarin for appropriate low-risk ED patients with newly diagnosed venous thromboembolism, but the discussion should include the degree of uncertainty associated with non-randomized observational studies.
So Jeff, I've got all these favorite parts to these SGEM episodes, but my most favorite is, how do you talk to patients? How do you take this data, this clinical stuff, this research, and apply it and actually have a conversation with the patients? So I'm wondering, what do you say to patients once you've diagnosed them with this pulmonary embolism? How do you approach it, and what language do you use when you're talking to them about starting one of these drugs?
Well, let me try to recount the words that I used. Tonight is Thursday. Tuesday night, I was working a 5-to-2 shift, and I was on our more minor side, and someone came over from the major side and said, "We've got a PE over here." And I went over and talked to him, and I looked at his CT scan, and he had a pretty good clot burden in his right main pulmonary artery. I happened to look at it and see that it was a little bit chronic. He also had a known concomitant DVT that they had diagnosed. His RV looked fine on CT scan. He was Hestia negative. They had happened to have done a troponin, an EKG, and a BNP that were all normal. So he had a relatively large clot burden, but all of his indices were negative. I went and talked to him, and I said, hey, I'm Jeff Klein. I'm interested in blood clots, and your doctors came over and got me. Do you know you have clots in your lungs? And you know what he said? No, I didn't know that. So I hadn't told him. And I said, okay. When he said, well, I know I have them in my leg. And I said, well, it looks like they sort of broke off and they went up into the right side of your heart, and the right side of your heart pumped them into your lungs. So they're kind of clogging up your lungs a little bit. And I bet you're getting a little short of breath when you go for a walk. And he said, yeah, that's why I came in. My wife made me come in. And she's sitting there at the bedside nodding her head up and down. I told you so. I told you so. And I said, you've got some clots in your lung. And this is an important thing I want every ER doctor to hear. When you have a patient with PE, tell them this. Everything's going to be okay. There's no reason not to tell them that. I know you're afraid that you'll tell them that and something horrible will happen. It won't. Tell them everything's going to be fine. You're going to be okay because we diagnosed you. This can be a really bad problem if it's not diagnosed properly. Now all we have to do is give you a pill to thin your blood. Now, for a long time, we used to give people a drug called Coumadin or warfarin. Do you know anybody that was on Coumadin or warfarin? If the patient knows the answer to that, then they know all about it. If they don't, then you can say, well, that was a pretty hard drug that made you have to get your fingers stuck and you had to take shots in your stomach. And usually about that time, that kind of rings and they kind of understand what you're talking about. And then I say, well, we don't have to do that anymore. We've got a drug that's been out for about 3 years now that lets us just give you pills. Now, I'm not sure how long you're going to need to take your pills, and you can say, you know, that depends on the next doctor, or you can say that's going to be at least for a couple of months. But all we need to do is start you on a pill here today and write you a prescription. Now, what kind of insurance do you have? Go through that for a second. Now, I'll give you a pill here tonight. Tomorrow morning, go to the pharmacy. You'll start taking pills twice a day. And then you can follow up with your doctor in a week and just ask them any questions. And all that has to happen is you've got to stay on this medicine for at least 6 months. You'll take two pills twice a day for 3 weeks, and then you'll take one pill a day after that until your doctor decides that you're done with the pills. And that's pretty much it.
That sound reminds me that it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Karsten Poulsen, who knew that a paperclip had the same amount of iron as Erich von Wolff calculated a serving of spinach contained, and he received a cool skeptical prize at the SMAC conference that was an S-Gem beer. Now, for the last Keener contest, or Gunner contest of the year, Jeff, you've got a special question for us.
So that question is, where does heparin derive its name from?
Oh, and if you know the answer to this Keener question, then send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener or Gunner in the subject line, and I will send you a cool skeptical prize. Well, that is the 42nd episode of the SGEM this year, and in keeping with the theme of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it will be the last regular episode of season number 3. But don't panic. Nope. There's no reason to hit the panic button. The SGEM will be back with 42 more structured critical reviews, including SGEM Hop episodes of recent literature, cutting that KT window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year. And please note, Lauren Westifer and Jeremy Faust from Foamcast, there was no jumping of the shark. Now, over the summer, I'll have a few SGEM extras. Like always, let me know what you think of the SGEM. I'm happy to hear your suggestions and feedback to make this even better, just like the SGEM Hop made it better this year. And if you wouldn't mind, please go to iTunes and maybe give me a 5-star rating, and like the SGEM on Facebook and follow on Twitter. Chris, thanks again for all your help in making the SGEM such a huge success.
Ken, it's my pleasure as always, and thanks for your eternal skepticism.
And Jeff, thanks for being our last guest of the year. And man, we are going out on top with such a great episode. And good luck with being the new editor-in-chief position.
Congrats, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Ken. And Chris, you guys have a great summer.
Now, before you leave, though, Jeff, we always ask the guest skeptic to give the tagline. But in your case, I want it in your best accent.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone in the fall.